Today I might speak about the matrix model, yes. Yes. So, let's see. How are we doing here? So I just wanted to remind you about what we were discussing last time. We were trying to define the partition function of 2D quantum gravity. So it involves the gravity action, the integration over geometries, the summation over topologies, and inclusion of matter fields. So that was the general continuum setup that we wanted to address. And well, in 2D, the action is somewhat simple. So it is just a cosmological term, which is lambda, the cosmological constant, times the area of the surface. And then this is a topological invariant, so we get the Euler characteristic divided by what I call the gravitational coupling constant. Here I call it kappa rather than g, because I have many g's appearing later. So we can write, we can decompose it, you see, in the sum of topologies with this part of the action, and then the partition function here for a given topology, depending only on the cosmological constant. And well, we'll come to this this expression later. So it was the kind of setup, but we also wanted to calculate other things than just the partition function, I mean, just the number. So we wanted to calculate Hartle-Hawking-like wave functions. Namely, we want to sum over, we fix the length of the boundary. So since we are only in two dimensions, I mean, specifying the metric here up to diffeomorphism is equivalent to specifying the length. So this is the diffeomorphism invariant boundary data that we have in two dimensions. So we have the lengths specified here. And then we want to calculate the corresponding expressions here. And it is convenient to introduce boundary cosmological constants, or alternatively, you could formulate it like if we have the Hartle-Hawking wave function, we can form a Laplace transformation to get an object like this. And these Laplace transformed objects here, the sets there, they act as boundary cosmological constants. So this is the length of the boundary times the boundary cosmological constants. So these are the objects that we want to calculate, and which I hopefully managed to calculate for you today. And well, I should say they're not so easy to calculate in the continuum, but they have been calculated in continuum, but they were first calculated using the framework that I'm going to discuss now. So the regularization that we employ is what we call dynamical triangulations, where we build up our manifold of these piecewise linear building blocks, the triangles, and then the integral over geometries is going to be the summation over topologies. So that was the kind of general kind of setup. And in this kind of discretized framework, the action becomes kind of very simple. So the action just becomes the number of triangles times the cosmological constant, and then here's the length of the boundary, it's just some integer number, and then times the boundary cosmological constants. And our Hartle-Hawking wave function will look like this. And if we include the boundary cosmological constants, it will look in this way here. So that was how we put it up. We have it here. This is the cosmological constant, the boundary cosmological constants. And we have this summation here. So here's the action in a discretized way, and these then reduced simply to the number of triangulations with a given number of triangles and a given length of the B boundaries that we have in mind. So it became a pure counting problem, and I prefer to change the notation from these kind of physical variables to some slightly different notation, which made the counting kind of more obvious. So I changed, although maybe more confusing in terms of physics, So I introduced a G, a G here is related to the cosmological constant, and the set I is related to the boundary cosmological constant and the ice boundary. And then our Hartle-Hawking wave function in terms of the coupling constant became equal to this. So this is basically the action which is standing there, and these are again the number of triangulations that we have in mind. So in this way, we can view these as kind of fugacities for, so this is a kind of, in chemical terms, this is a fugacity for injecting triangles in this kind of setup, so that the larger G is, that means the smaller the cosmological constant is, the more likely it is to have a large area, many triangles. And similar with the sets, so they're defined with a plus rather than a minus, so the smaller set is, the more likely it is to have large boundaries. And what we already have seen in the particle case is, and also we kind of saw last time, is that there are critical values of the set such that the boundary length goes to infinity. And what we will start to discuss today is also how the critical, there are critical values of this, such that the number of triangles are going to explode. And this is exactly where we want to take the continuum limit, because we don't want, we're not interested in the part of this which consists of five triangles and boundary lengths of two. They have nothing to do with continuum physics. We are interested in taking a limit where there are infinite many triangles and the length of this also goes to infinity. But it's clear that we solve this problem by counting these numbers. And in counting, the general way of counting is to solve for the generating function of these numbers. And that was what we call the loop equations that we wrote down. And as I mentioned, this counting problem was actually solved long before the physicists got interested in this. So Todde, in 62, he wrote down the equation, counting equation, which I showed to you, for the situation where we have one boundary. So this is really the kind of Hartle-Hawking wave function, where you start out from nothing, and then you evolve into one boundary. So the Hartle-Hawking wave function here, so Todde wrote down the equation for the Hartle-Hawking wave function in 62. Yeah. Okay, so this is a disk.
This is clear.
This is a disk. Yeah, this is a disk. And we have a mark on one of the links. And then it's just telling, this counting is kind of confusing because it's so simple and still, counting is, combinatorials is a difficult topic in mathematics because it's very simple if you do it correctly, but the probability that you do it wrongly is quite large. So it's just telling you what can happen here. So either this link belongs to a triangle, this is what is here, then it will look like this. So there is a triangle, and then there can be anything here. Here is anything in principle. So either it belongs to a triangle, or it belongs to one of these double links, which I also allowed. And then it looks like this. So that's basically it. So that's all what can happen. And now you just formulate it in terms of this is anything, this is anything, this is anything, this is anything. But of course, you want to have the same number of triangles and the same number of links in these equations, else it's not an identity. So if you have, say, k triangles here, then it's clear that on this thing here, you have only k minus one triangles. So how do you make sure that you only extract k minus one triangles? Well, you extract the k's power of this expression here. So you multiply by k, by g here, and then when you extract the k power, you will extract the k minus one power of this thing here. So that's why you make sure that there's one triangle less in this green area than in this. Well, this is that you extract g to the k's power, they're exactly k triangles, and the length of the boundary is L.
And in the first step, what do I extract?
Here? They're k triangles, so you extract g to the k and z to the minus l plus 1.
What does it mean?
Well, this is a power series in these. You take out the term, which is there. Because that is the number of triangles, or triangulations with this number of triangles and this length of boundary. So you want to extract this number, and you do the same here and here. So that is the meaning of this combinatorial equation. So in a way, it's very simple. But of course, well, as you know from counting, it's very difficult to get things right in combinatorial. And that's why this is too complicated for the physicist in general. And that's why they will turn to matrix models kind of eventually. But what I want to say is that actually this is very nice, and the mathematicians, they did it, and they did it before we did it. So they deserve credit for this. And it somehow adds an additional flavor to this, namely that we understand precisely what is going on in terms of triangulations. So we were solving this loop equation. And I argued to you that the solution had the following structure here. So it was equal to a polynomial here and a polynomial here, and then this kind of square root singularity structure. And in the case for the triangles, this is just simply, this is a second order polynomial, and this is a first order polynomial. But there is, of course, some subtleties in this formula. It just doesn't look like this because we know by construction this function was constructed such that the first term in this in an inverse power series of Z falls off like 1 over Z. And you see that this is a polynomial in Z. So this grows as Z squared. And this is a first order polynomial in Z. And from here, there is also here when Z is large, and we can extract from power on Z. So these powers, they have to cancel. So the second order power has to cancel, the first order power has to cancel, and the zeroth order power has to cancel in order that this expression here is going to kind of start out as 1 over Z. And it's exactly this requirement which will fix eventually this position of this cot and this cot as a function of the coupling constant G, which enters. And so the problem is how to do this in a kind of organized way to actually find the solution. So this was where we got to last time, namely we want to understand basically how to extract these two as a function of G. That is required for us to actually solve the problem quite precisely. What I will do here is that I will not really solve the problem for you explicitly, although in this case here, where we have only triangles, it turns out to be a third order equation, and it can be solved explicitly. But rather, I will give some kind of general arguments for this, precisely what is the behavior of these things. So let us again emphasize the physics of this, rather than the kind of mathematics. So let us understand again how is this certain non-analyticity in these expressions, and how is this non-analyticity, for instance, in the gravitational coupling constant, how is it linked to the exponential growth of the number of triangulations of a given number k? So in order to illustrate this, let me take the function again here, and let me first make a summation over boundary lengths. Then I get something which depends on the boundary cosmological constant, and then the power series here in the number of triangles. So this is given explicitly in this way here. Now assume for a second, we haven't proven it, but let us assume that this number here, it grows exponentially with k, such that the number of triangulations you can form with a given number of triangles grows exponentially. Then it has a form like this, where this is a slowly varying function of k and l. And if this is the case, it means that all these functions k here, and you might recall that we calculated it for k equal to 0 when there was no triangles and only boundaries. We actually did the calculation and we got this branch polymer thing. But now we'll do the more general calculation where there are triangles. So it will have this form. So each of them will grow here in the same way. E sub these functions, because if you assume that, that the numbers have this form here. And now we plug this into here, and you see that this function has a behavior like this. Under this assumption that the number of triangulations grow exponentially with the number of triangles. Then this will have a function like this. So you see that this exponential growth here, dictated here, is exactly the radius of convergence of this function here. So for g larger than this, that means the cosmological constant smaller than a certain value, this partition function simply diverges. And for g kind of less than this, it is convergent. And convergent, if we just take g to be half of this, for instance, it just means that there's hardly any triangles present here, because it's just a fast convergent series, and the main weight of this geometric series is, of course, for small numbers of k, because this will be 1/2 to the k, and there will be 2 or 3 triangles typically present. This is not a situation we're interested in. We're interested in a situation where a typical number will diverge, and this is exactly when g approaches this, because then this number is 1, and any k here has the same weight. So large k will, of course, by definition, then be very important because the series is divergent there. So exactly when g goes to d critical, the number of triangles will diverge. So that is the region that we are interested in. So I'm assuming here that this is a slowly varying function of k. It can fall off like 1 over k to some power, but it's not growing exponentially. Yeah, that is the assumption. But this is how it turns out to be, and I'm just trying here to illustrate to you the consequences of this. So now, if we now look at the solution that we actually had claimed has this form here, then I can now sum over k, and I get some functions like this. And for each of the, so how can this be non-analytic in G? Well, in several ways, but the most natural way for it to be non-analytic in G is if these coefficients themselves are non-analytic in G. Now, if you take a look at this expression here, then you see that if you expand inverse powers of Z here, then these functions here are simple polynomials in C plus and C minus G, the positions of the cut on the real axis. So it is natural to say that the non-analyticity in these coefficients, since they are just polynomials in these, can only occur if these coefficients themselves are non-analytic functions of G. And this is exactly what turns out to be the case. So we saw that for the branch polymer case, there was simply plus 2 and minus 2. And then when we increased G, this was an increasing function. But at some critical value, it turns out that it will be a non-analytic function of G. And let's try to understand how this occurs, because this is what dictates the nature of the continuum limit. So for that purpose, I will write down the solution for you in a certain way, specific way. But maybe before that, this we are not going to use right now, but I will nevertheless, it's a natural place to introduce it, because it will allow me to introduce this contour here. So we have our cut here, and we now have our value of our boundary cosmological constant set. In principle, it's a real value, but now I will allow it to take values also in the complex plane, just for the point of view of these equations. Now, our loop equation, it was like this. It was a second order equation. I can trivially kind of rewrite it in this way here, as an integral equation over a complex contour, if I know that this function has a cut here. This is a kind of triviality, because you see, so this value of Z is outside the contour. And now if you deform this contour out to infinity, then you see that you hit a pole. That pole term produces exactly this term here. And now when you are out at infinity, since this has an inverse power expansion in 1 over W, when you do the integration out at infinity, these inverse powers, only if the total power is minus one, you get a contribution. So expanding, you pick up, this is a positive power expansion. So you pick up the first coefficient, W1, W2, et cetera, depending on the size of the polynomial here, out at infinity. And that is exactly this polynomial that we had here. So it's a kind of trivial kind of rewriting. It depended exactly on the coefficients here and the first coefficient in this series. So it's just a trivial kind of rewriting. It can be written like this. So we will not use this right now, but it allows me to introduce this kind of contour here, which will be useful for us. Let us return again to the loop equation and try to understand the analytic structure of it. So we had it like this, where this was a polynomial. Now, for any polynomial, we can represent it like this, as a contour out at infinity. Because again, if we expand in inverse powers z or w, then only the power minus 1 will contribute. And this will pick up the coefficients of this polynomial and multiply them by z. And you reproduce this again. But now, assume that we have this solution here. Then m here can, of course, be solved in terms of these two functions. But this falls off like 1 over z. So when we insert it here, it will never contribute to this integral out at infinity. Only this term here divided by this will contribute. So we have this explicit representation. So you see here that we have an expression of this polynomial here. Assuming that this falls off like 1 over z, we have an expression of this polynomial in terms of the potential here and these cuts here. And we can expand it in the following way. So we can simply power expand this. So this is if this is an n-order polynomial, if this is an m-order polynomial, it has this kind of trivial expansion here, where we expand these coefficients, and these m's are given in this way here. So it is nice. Well, any polynomial can of course be expanded in this way here. There's nothing dubious about it. I just want to emphasize that there is an explicit expression of these coefficients in terms of the potential and the cut. The reason I want to write the polynomial exactly in this way is that we want eventually to take z to the value of the cut here, because this is exactly when the length of the boundary goes to infinity. So it's nice to have an expression of the polynomial exactly in this way here. In our case, this polynomial was very simple. It was just a first-order polynomial, so it can be written like this, where these are two coefficients here. So this is just a kind of trivial kind of rewriting. So now, returning again to our loop equation and the solution. So we have the solution here. With this contour C I introduced, this solution can trivially be written in this way here. So this is a kind of closed form of writing it in terms of the cuts and the value of the coupling constants, which are buried in this polynomial here. And you see that this is trivially true, because if you deform this contour out to infinity, you first pass the value z. That gives a pole term. That gives exactly this term here, because this coefficient here is 1 when w is equal to z. And now when you go out at infinity, then you get exactly the definition of m I just gave you. That is this one times this function here. This function doesn't depend on, you can take this out of the integration if you want. So you see that this is just a trivial kind of rewriting of this equation. But now, using this equation, that this has to fall off like 1 over z, by definition. And then power expands this in z. So we first have a constant term. When z is very large, this goes out as a constant. Cancel this one here. So you have a value here. This value has to be equal to 0, because there is no constant term here by assumption. Then the next term, since this starts with a coefficient 1 over z, then the next term in the expansion has to be equal to 1. And this is expressed by a similar integral here. So this is kind of trivial manipulations. The main point here is just that, so these m's are like the other m's I just defined for you. The main point is here, there are just two integral equations. And there are two unknowns, namely the position of this and this in terms of the coupling constants which are here. So in principle, you can solve these equations. And there is a unique solution, and it is the one which solves our combinatorial problem. So now for the final part of the story, the non-analyticity of these coefficients here, the cuts. Well, so when do they become non-analytic? Well, again, you could solve this explicitly and have some equations, and you could look at them. And this was, of course, how people did it in the beginning. But there is another way to look at it, which is completely general and will apply in the general case. It turns out that the non-analyticity is associated with M1, the coefficient in this polynomial. When this coefficient, it goes to zero, this is exactly where this function becomes kind of non-analytic. And I will not present these arguments for you. It's kind of trivial mathematics. You had to work it out, of course, but it's kind of trivial mathematics. But I would just say that if you analyze, so what turns out to be the case is that when g is less than the, so call this value where this coefficient is equal to zero, call it the critical value. It turns out that when g is less than g critical, then this coefficient is larger than zero, and the other coefficient is less than zero. And now we approach this value, and looking at these integrals, how they were defined, it's a kind of trivial algebra to work out that what happens is that M1 is proportional to the difference between the value of the cut at the critical point and at the actual value g that you are choosing. So you define delta g to be like this, and this to be like this. Then it's easy to work out, but I'll not do the details here, that this is equal to this, and this is equal to this. So they both go to zero, of course, when g goes to d critical, because this is where this is zero. But you see that this thing, as a function of g, is non-analytic, exactly at that point. So this is how it happened, technically. Now let us understand what it means in terms of physics, because it's kind of interesting. It has to do with the boundary lengths. So now let us start in a situation where we take g to be less than kind of d critical. So this means that there are not so many triangles, only a few triangles in the case. So we know that we should somehow get the branch polymer situation coming back in some way if g is less than g critical. So we take now set to the critical value, and you see that this partition function basically becomes, so it is given by this, and the non-analytic part of it, which dominates when set goes to set critical, is given by M1, because that is just a constant times this term here. So the non-analytic part goes like a square root here. And this was exactly what we saw in the branch polymer case. I'll discuss the length assignment kind of in a second. Now, suppose that we move closer to the critical point such that this coefficient is 1. Then we have to go to the next coefficient, and then it goes like this. So it changes power here. Now, how is this power, how is it related to the length of the boundary? Well, it is related in the following way. Let's do it explicitly here. So suppose I have an expression like this to some power gamma. Now let me power expand this in inverse powers of set. So set is larger than this. I power expand it in inverse powers of set. I have something like this. And the power expansion is exactly this one here. Right, there are some coefficients, but it is kind of like this. So you see, naively, if you integrate this up, replace the sum by integration, then you will reproduce a term like this. So this is what it looks like. Now, in terms of this function here, it is the number of boundaries at this given length here. So you see that if this function has this form here, then the number of boundaries is given by this explicit formula. So you see that the subleading correction to the exponential is governed by this exponent here. So now let us go up and now let's go down here and see. So if we are away from G critical, then we found something like this. So the subleading exponent to the exponential growth of the boundary is equal to 3/2, and that was what we explicitly constructed for the branch polymers. But now let us move to G critical, where the number of triangles goes to infinity. And then let us also take there set to set critical. Then the boundary, then this exponent changed from 1/2 to 3/2, and the subleading exponent here, it changes from 3/2 to 5/2. And this is the value in 2D, in 2D quantum gravity. Now, to appreciate this, you will say, well, but come on, I mean, this is a minor change. I mean, the leading part is here. So why are we worried about this? But it's not like that. I mean, so I want to recall or tell you, if you are not an expert in critical phenomena, the point is that in the theory of critical phenomena, the value of the critical point itself is non-universal. Now, the value of the critical point here is this thing here. And this means this particular value which governs the exponential growth. This is non-universal. Had I chosen another class of triangulations than the one I was actually taking, I would have got another value of this set critical. However, the subleading contributions here, these are what we call the critical exponents. They are universal. So it doesn't matter what class of triangulations I would have taken, I would always find the same critical exponents here. So these are the ones where the physical significance of the theory is lying. And you see that there is a transition change here, and this is simply then kind of reflecting the fact that in this case here, we are talking about boundaries of real surfaces, because number of triangles are going to infinity. While in this case here, there are only very few triangles, and this is basically the surface or the number of branch polymers that you can have. So you see how these approach to the critical point are kind of dictated, and how you can derive them without much actually doing detailed calculations. Now, I want to generalize what I've just said here, in order that you can appreciate that it doesn't depend on the details of the triangulations. This is one thing. So this is point one in the generalizations, which will emphasize universality. Then I want to introduce, so we have just looked at the Hartle-Hawking wave function. I then want to introduce many boundaries in it. And then I want to introduce higher genus surfaces. And I want to, although I will not give you really the details, I want to hopefully can persuade you that things can be solved without much difficulties compared to what we already have done. So here's the loop equation. So before I had this term and this term here, triangles and double links. Now I allow squares, pentagons, hexagons, even two guns and one guns, whatever that means. We can just allow them. So it's kind of very, kind of the surfaces are kind of degenerated there, but we can allow them if you want without any. It doesn't change the results. So the general equation is going to look like this. Now, so the polynomial we are considering. So how should we view this as a counting problem? Well, we can view it as a counting problem in the following way. We can associate a relative weight to each n gun. Let me call it Ti, and then a general kind of fugacity to all of them. Call it G. So the coupling constant associated with each kind of polygon is G times Ti, and we keep these Ti fixed, positive or zero, if we don't want them to be in our counting, and then we vary G here. So we have still one cosmological coupling constant in the game. Now, of course, the counting, so we now have a potential, which looks like this. Our definition of our Hartle-Hawking wave function now includes not only triangulations, but all kinds of these objects. We just glue them together in all possible ways, associating a weight Ti to each of them. They still have a number, given number of one guns, two guns, triangles, squares, et cetera, et cetera. And the boundary And they have a corresponding weight here in terms of the boundary cosmological constant and the cosmological constant. The loop equation is exactly the same. And the solution is exactly the same, except that this polynomial now is of higher order. But this still is supposed to fall off like 1 over z. So many, many cancellations have to take place here in order that this happens, because now this is a high order polynomial and this is a high order polynomial. But still, the solution is unique. So it's exactly the same solution, and exactly what I've said is still valid. So we still have a branch polymer phase as a kind of generic phase, and a fine-tuning of G is going to give us a two-dimensional quantum gravity. So you see that it's really independent of the details of the triangulations we are using. Now I want to go to multi-loop, which were one of the goals that we put out. They can be constructed knowing this expression, having solved this expression, knowing this expression, one can easily construct these actually in the following, at least formal way, but it actually also works in practice, using what we call a loop insertion operator. So this is, in a way, a very simple-minded operation, which amazingly enough actually really allows you to calculate these objects kind of from this object. And even more surprisingly, it turns out that these objects are, in a way, much simpler than this object itself. That is a kind of surprise. So what is this loop insertion operator? Well, it does something very simple. So recall this expression here. So take one of the powers out here, j, gj to the kj. So what does it mean? It means that in our surface, we have a polygon, a j-gon, and we have, in fact, k of them. That's what it means. Now I want to take it out and replace it with a boundary, a hole. What does it mean? Well, it means that I have to decrease the power of this by 1, because after I take it out, I only have k minus 1 of them. But there are k of them, so I can do it in k different ways. There's 1 here, there's 1 here. I can take this out, I can take this out. Each time I take it out, I create a different surface. So I have to multiply by k. And I get this by differentiating after k. So you see, differentiating reduces exactly with 1 power and multiply by k. Next, now I have this boundary. I also want to associate a boundary cosmological constant to it. That I do by dividing by 1 over z. So I have already 1 here associated with the original boundary, but now I introduce a new boundary, and I assign the value 1 over z to j plus 1. S is done everywhere. And then I want to put a mark on it that I can do on each of the link. So I should multiply by j. So this is how this factor comes. So differentiating this expression after all possible coupling constants there is going to produce another loop. There was 1 loop already here, one boundary here. And acting with this is going to produce another boundary. Differentiating 1 more time with this operator will produce another boundary, etc. Well, it might seem that you cannot do this in practice, but you can. It turns out that it's actually quite easy to operate this guy. So in this way, you can calculate the multi-loop correlators. And I will show you an expression for them later. Now, finally, higher genus. Let us count. We go the whole way now. So what happens? So now, before I assumed it was a disk. Now let me assume that it's not a disk, but it's a genus H surface with 1 hole, 1 boundary here. So what can happen now? Well, for the triangle, so let's assume it only consists of triangles and double links, just to make it simple. What can happen? Well, the same as before, the mark is on a triangle. And now if it is on a double link, then this part of the surface must have genus H1 up here and H minus H1 here. Well, that's one possibility. And then we have all possible combinations can occur. But also, it might be that they do not separate in 2 disconnected parts, but they are connected here because it's a higher genus surface. So I've drawn it here so you can see in more detail what is really happening in this situation. So here in this surface here, I mean, we have the boundary here, and it looks like this, the double link here. We take it away, and it separates in two surfaces, one of genus H1 and one of genus H minus H1. In this case here, we have the boundary here and the double link here. So it looks like this. And now we take the double link away. We have something like this. So the surface is of H minus 1. It will lose one genus by this. But the two boundaries have the same boundary cosmological constant because they came from the same boundary here. So the loop equation can be written in this way here. So you see, it's a recursive relation which determines W of H from W of kind of from the lower genus and the two loop function of lower genus. But the two loop function of lower genus, we of course know if you know the one loop function, because I just explained to you how you can get multi loop functions. So in principle, you can solve this kind of recursively. Yeah. Well, anything is allowed to appear here, and anything is allowed to appear here. And in principle, well, you can put this dot here, or you can put it here. It's the same. You can say you have the same situation. Your question doesn't have to be addressed to genus. You can say, suppose I have a triangulation here and a triangulation here. How do I distinguish between these two? Can they not occur upside down and so on? But the point is that if you rotate it, the dot will appear on the other side, so you can distinguish it in principle. So that's the answer. So we have this equation here, and now it's a summation here. But now let me write it as one equation by introducing the generating functional for all genus. So we have these things, we have calculated them for each genus now. Let me introduce the generating function for all of them. So I just put in what I call n here, and you will see later what this n means actually in terms of matrix models. But I just put it in here as a new variable in the same way as these. In fact, it will be related to the gravitational coupling constant, as we will see. Then we can write a formal expansion like this. And I put here formal because unfortunately you will see it would be very formal, but nevertheless, it's a very exciting object because this is really what we want to calculate if we want to sum over all topologies. And now this object satisfies this closed equation here. So if we can solve this equation here, we have solved for the full thing here. So this is our final loop equation here. Maybe this is a good point to stop here because after having derived this equation, I want to show to you how all this counting can be made kind of automatic using matrix models. No real further insight is obtained by these matrix models. That's why I have been a little bit kind of resistant to deal with them. But when we ourselves kind of derived these multi-loop kind of correlators, we were indeed using the matrix models. This combinatorial way of looking at it came kind of later, but conceptually it's nice. But if you just want formal things, the matrix models, as I will show to you, is a kind of neat tool to obtain these equations in a formal way. So let's postpone that to after the break. Thank you. Yeah, you can.
Do they work?
Well, I don't know what you mean by gluing. I'm free to do whatever I like. Yeah.
I mean, the final partition function is the one you would expect. For a cylinder, you glue only one end, and you get still the amplitude for a cylinder.
Well, it will set, but since by definition it sums over everything, it will satisfy any requirement if you do it correctly. Any requirement that you would, Well, yes. But as we will see, it's not so easy to define the sum over these things. I mean, this is a formal power series. Well, I'm not sure I fully understand precisely what you mean. I mean, you think about the gluing properties of topological field theory.
Yes, I mean, yeah. Do you have them here? Or
well, not necessarily arbitrary. This is not, by definition, a topological field theory. But I will address many of the questions that you ask, I think, kind of later. Yes. Okay.